everybody. My name's David Bray. I'm an alcoholic. And it is truly by God's grace. I've got a sobriety date of January 2nd, 1981. And for that period of time, I'm very, very grateful. I want to thank the committee and anybody that had anything to do with putting this event on. And, you know, I look out at this group of men and realize that there's an awful lot of alcoholics that will never see what we're taking for granted this weekend. An awful lot of alcoholics will never get the opportunity to sit amongst 300 men of recovery sharing what goes on in Alcoholics Anonymous and in Al-Anon, and that they might have an opportunity to get rid of the trash of their life and start the process of rebuilding a new one. And so I know tonight that it is a privilege for me to be with you. That I didn't do anything prior to getting to Alcoholics Anonymous, nor a long time after I was here, that allows me the right to be with you. That for whatever reason, God has given me an opportunity to recognize his power in my life and then try to turn around and share that with the next person who comes through our door. There's a lot of strong sobriety in here. Now, all the people that stood up with a year or less, I congratulate you for being here. I can tell you that if this is your first time at Man to Man, or if it's your first time at a conference similar to this, if this is your first event where you've had to, maybe you were coerced by a sponsor to get here. But what I tell the man that I sponsor is the first one's really not the hardest one to come to. It's the second one, because next year you're going to be on your own. You're going to have to get here. You're going to have to maintain that little bit of willingness to come back. You're also going to have to maintain your sobriety to come back, and sometimes that's a challenge. I want to thank. Bob and I have had great. We've shared the room together, and we've had great conversations. And it's the first time I've met Bob, so I've appreciated the opportunity to spend time with your speaker tomorrow morning. David, thank you for your talk last night. You did an excellent job. Thank you. And I want to thank the man that I sponsored that drove down 7 hours with me. And Byron, thanks for being here. I'm just happy to be here. I know you might not notice this. I'm just looking for a starting point. So I think what I'd like to do is start. I'm gonna give you the definition of three words. I'm not going to tell you the words yet, just the definitions. Definition of the first word. Perpetual agitation.
Marriage.
Definition of the second word, number three, my personal favorite. Abnormally sensitive. Definition of third word, relentless craving to obtain something I currently don't have. So hang on to that. I'll get back, hopefully. Sometimes I go a different direction. I may never get back, but I'll start there. I grew up in the city of Chicago. I was born there. Grew up there. My father played professional baseball in the Cubs system. He never made it to the major leagues. He was a pitcher. He blew his arm. He got to the double A level, and then he blew his arm out. I've got two older brothers, so athletics was a big part of my growing up. You can't tell, but it was. And if you hear a lot of speakers from behind that podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, and inevitably you're going to hear somebody say at a point in their life they felt like they didn't belong, that they just didn't measure up. I've got two older brothers who were good athletes. My brother pitched in high school, was an excellent golfer. The middle brother, he lettered in baseball, football, and basketball during his high school career. He played college football. I hated him. I'm 3 years younger than the middle brother, and I've always been a little dumpy. I get from A to B a little slower. I'm gravity challenged. I remember as a little kid, my dad would take us on runs. If you want to torture a fat kid, take him on a run. Some of the longest singles in Little League history. a shot in the gap, and I knew that's three. And I'd get around, I'd make that turn, going around first, and look how far second was, and shut her down. It was like that. Shit. I think we'll play small ball from here. You know, just. I went out for football my freshman year in high school, because that's what Braves do, you go out for football. I found out about week end of the season, I've got a problem with my back. I've got a big yellow streak right down the middle of it. When the guy with the ball's running at you and you step aside, coach doesn't appreciate that. The school that I played for had four freshman football teams, A squad, B squad, C squad, D squad. And I was on the bench of the C squad. I didn't make it all the way down to the derelicts, but I was close. And I remember the last week of football practice, the coach came up to me. He goes, "You know, Bray, for a guy that shows up to practice every single day, you're without a doubt the worst football player I've ever seen in my life." He was right. I stunk. So the next sport I went out to for was tennis. That's a visual. Fat kid on a tennis court. Had a good serve, but if the other guy returned it, point over. Running back and forth wasn't, you know, up and back wasn't so bad, but when you threw inside to side, that's just way too much damn running. So my tennis career was short. Next sport I went out for was a game of golf. Golf is a perfect sport for a guy like me. What you find out about golf is once you hit it, you don't got to run. Just walk after it. The next thing you find out is once you get away from the clubhouse where the coaches are, because the coaches never come out, is you can hit it, light up a cigarette. Walk after it. A little bit later, what you find out is you can hit it, light up a lot of stuff out there. Walk after it. And by the time you're done, you don't even care if you find it most of the times. And so I became pretty good at the game of golf fairly quickly, and by the time I was 16 years old, I was playing to a one handicap, and I had some opportunity in the game of golf. That is, you know, book talks about that we live double lives. So that's one of my doubles, is I had some opportunity in that game. I took my first drink somewhere between the age of 12 and 13. That's all I did. I just took a drink. Didn't mean anything by it. Somebody say, "You want to take a drink?" When you're 12 or 13, sounds like a good idea. Just took a drink. I didn't go run under a bridge, live under a bridge right after that. I just took a drink. Something happened, but I certainly recall the first time that alcohol had that effect upon me. And I know today, because of sponsorship, because of our book, and because people who cared to tell me the truth, to say, let's get in and let's find out if you are one of us. I know today that alcohol has an effect upon me that does not have on other drinkers. There's an awful lot of people who drink alcohol that they'll never have the effect that alcohol has upon on me, because I'm an alcoholic of the type our book describes. I developed this thing called phenomenon of craving. I didn't know that that's what I had. I just have it. By the time I was 16, I was a daily drinker. So now I'm at that state. I'm at that point. I have an opportunity and something that I love to do, play golf. I now have got the craving so bad that when I start to drink, I want to drink and I want to drink. And now I have to, little by little, make choices in my life. And that's where I am. When our book describes three types of drinkers, moderate drinker, don't understand the moderate drinker, I'm thinking about petitioning to start a new holiday. Slap a moderate drinker day. You know, you see a moderate drinker, just slap the crap out of them. They just piss me off. That's alcohol abuse as far as I'm concerned. Heavy drinker. Book says we got a certain type of heavy drinker. May cost him his life a few years before his time. May cause him some medical problems. Today I know my father is a heavy drinker. My dad is 84 years old. My dad's probably drank more booze than a lot of people in this room. And he is not an alcoholic. My dad drinks a lot. And he's always had one ability that I don't have, And that's when he wanted to, he can stop or moderate. And he could never understand why I couldn't. And I don't understand how he can. Because when I start to drink alcohol, I have this craving I didn't know. And I have to continue to drink at the expense of other things in my life. By the time I go through high school, I go to a junior college in outside of Chicago, and I'm on the golf team. I'm 18 years old, and the golf team that I'm on, it's a small college. Not many people went out for the golf team. There's only five of us. And so we play every tournament, every hole of every tournament. We ended up winning the Illinois State Championship. And the following month, they sent us to Odessa, Texas, to play in the junior college national championship. And if you're a golfer, you know that in a golf tournament, there's two ways to qualify. Four rounds. After two rounds, they cut the field in half. You can qualify as a team if your team does well. If your team doesn't do well, you can still qualify as an individual. Our team didn't qualify. But as an individual, I did. By this time, though, in my drinking, when I start to drink, really one of three things happens. I have three endpoints when I start to drink. Run out, black out, pass out. And that is it. That's all I have. And I'll tell you, of the three, the worst is run out. I have done some of the most absurd, violent, criminal actions of my life when I need to drink and don't have any. I'm sure all of you have heard the definition that you might hear sometimes in the rooms of insanity. Do the same thing over. Okay? I'll tell you, for me, I have a definition of insanity. If I'm drinking and you try to stop me, you're insane. Because I'm going to drink. I'm going to do what it's necessary to drink. So after the second round of this golf tournament, the guys that don't make the cut, they don't got nothing to do for the rest of the trip. Two of us made the cut. One of the guys that didn't make said, hey, why don't we go have a beer? Now that's, he said that, and he meant that. I can't recall any time in my life ever having a beer. I don't know if I've ever had a anything, but I certainly have never had a drink. So this is one of those times where I can't stop. My tea time the following morning was at 7. 5:30 in the morning, I'm getting back. I can't find my shoes. I'm still drunk. On two times during this tournament, I had to purposely hit the ball into the tree, so I go in there and vomit. Had to hit the ball back out. What I did not realize at that very minute is I had just played the last competitive round of golf that I would ever play. I did not know that I just gave up the dream that I had to make something of it, because at that point, drinking took me past where I ever imagined it could take me. Get through that junior college. I go to Northern Illinois University. It's in DeKalb. It's about 40 miles west of Chicago, out in the cornfield. You know, Illinois without Chicago is really Iowa. It's just corn. That's all it is. And DeKalb is a cornfield with some of the corn cut out, and they put some buildings up, and they called it Northern Illinois University. And this is my last hurrah. I don't know if you've ever come to in a black. I came to out one time out of a blackout, and I'm in the middle, and I mean the middle of a large cornfield. I do not know how I got to the middle. So I'm in the middle. And when you're in the middle of a cornfield, oh, shit, you pick a direction and you just walk and you hope you hit a road. But that's one of the things. So I'm at Northern Illinois University, and this is the moment that for the first time in my life, I'm away from home and there aren't any rules. There's no control. And I have none. One quick story. One of the favorite things on a college campus is Halloween. And we celebrated Halloween for about a week before and a week after. And in 1980, there was a movie that came out called The Warriors. And it was a movie about gangs. And one of the gangs in this movie was called the Baseball Furies. And they painted their face red and white. I wouldn't need any red today, but they painted their face red and white and wore baseball uniforms and carried baseball bats. And so a bunch of us knuckleheads decided we're going to go to this party as the Baseball Furies. So I don't have a baseball bat, so I went into my closet, which was one of those single door ones, and it had an oak closet pole. So I grab my oak closet pole, dress up, and go to the party. Now this is one of those times when I drink and I black out. Now the story that was told to me is this, is that so about 3 o'clock in the morning, somebody saw me walking across DeKalb in a direction other than where I lived. And they brought me back to the apartment, and I came into the apartment, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and my hands are full of blood, and I've got about this much of the closet pole left, and they said, ooh, I was hurting people. Now, I don't remember. This was told to me the following morning. I spent about 2 days looking in the newspapers from DeKalb. Most college campuses have their own newspaper, and you look, and they usually have a section of the police reports looking for some information about whatever nefarious crime just took place, seeing if there was any kind of information about some guy with a red face and with a closet pole beating on people. And I don't find it. And so I do with that information what I've done with everything that I've ever done, ridiculous or crazy or violent. I just push it aside. And I think to myself, if you're stupid enough to be out with me when I'm drinking, you deserve what you get. And that's how I live my life. I go home for the Christmas break with like a under one GPA. And my parents, between Christmas and New Year's, my father's company has a Christmas party, and so they're out of the house, but the two brothers are already gone. And this is one of those nights where I invite a couple people over. And, you know, you invite 2 or 3 over, and about 98 show up. Now, this will not be the first time that my parents' home has been damaged. It won't be the first or the second or the 10th or the 20th or the 50th time that I've done things that have impact on what my parents' home is. I can't tell you how many times they'd come home and find me passed out, sometimes in a puddle of my own vomit. I can't tell you how many times I lied to them and stole from them and destroyed their dignity. And this is one of those nights when I drink and I pass out, and I'm not in a position where I can protect my parents' home. And it's the damage was so complete that in my parents' upstairs bedroom, where they were, on the upper shelf of their closet is their lockbox with all the important papers. And my mom, 2 days later, found that in the basement behind the furnace, just beat to crap. Now, the only saving grace was that they couldn't get in to the lockbox. Now, the amazing part of that is that the box wasn't locked. That the only thing that prevented the thieves getting to whatever they were looking for was like one of those little lunchbox latches. But I guess in their stupor, they couldn't figure it out, so they just beat the box up and jammed it behind the furnace. But there's no lie you can tell for that. I'm the only one there. The damage was complete. Most of the stuff was stolen. Furniture is damaged. The last thing my father said to me before I came to you, and there's moments in, I don't know about your sobriety, I don't know where you were a week before you got sober, I don't know where you were, you know, the book talks about how dark it is before the dawn, and I don't know where your darkness is. I hope you don't ever forget that. Because if what our book says is true, wherever that moment where you know, I can't take another, I can't take it anymore. But if what our book says is true, if you start drinking again, that's as good as it's ever going to be. Because it says over any considerable period, it gets worse, never better. Now, I can tell you from personal experience, many people that I've tried to help in our program have said, I'm done. I can't live at this level anymore. This is the lowest my life's ever been, and they go back out and drink, and it does get worse. Three or four months ago, a guy that I used to sponsor hung himself for a tree. He couldn't do what we do. And so I hope that I don't ever forget the way that my father looked at me. My father looked at me with a contempt and a hatred that a father should never have for a son. And the last thing that he said to me was, Dave, you know, with a son like you, I don't need any enemies. You make me sick. I can't stand another minute, and I need you to be gone. Now, what I don't know, and my father told a story at my 25th AA birthday, and I had never heard it. What I didn't realize was that morning, it was just me and him in the house, but what I didn't realize, and he told the story at my 25th AA birthday, he said to my mom that morning, he said, I need you to leave, and that you need to know that when you get back, probably one of us will be dead. He was planning to kill me because he just couldn't take it anymore. And that's who walked through your door. So I get through this treatment center. Treatment has nothing to do with my sobriety. I was a guy that was so angry when I got here. When I went to this treatment center, I didn't make your moccasins. I didn't participate in crafts. I didn't join in. We had one guy that would always dress up in a green suit, and we had to sit in front of it. He'd play the piano, and I'm out of it, and he's playing some goofy frog song, and I'm not participating, and I just can't stand it. I don't do anything. At that time, big books were $10,000. Okay, so I got 28 days later, I got my $10,000 big book, and they got me out of there. I go through this halfway house in Maywood. It's called the Way Back In. What a ridiculous idea, halfway house. To this day, I don't know what it's halfway from or halfway to. But it's really a stupid idea. This one was 15 brand new members of Alcoholics Anonymous all stuck in one place. Do you know what 15 brand new men of Alcoholics Anonymous talk about? I can promise you it ain't the happy road of destiny. We're looking for the loose women. All right? We are not concentrating on sobriety. And something very important happened to me at this moment. The guy that was my best friend in this halfway house, my new best friend. We make new best friends when we're new. I don't know his name, but he's my best friend. And he got drunk. I was about 3 months sober, and he got drunk. And they kicked him out, one of the rules of the house. And so I find out about it, and I decided, well, I'm going to go see if I can talk to him. And so I get to his apartment, and he lets me in, and he's in a recliner. It's the only piece of furniture in the apartment. And he's got a bottle of Jack Daniels and a case of beer, and Jack Daniels happened to be the thing I like to drink. And I said, hey, man, you want to go to a meeting? He said, no, you want to drink. Now, at this point, it's like a book talks about, I'm not happy about my sobriety. And I say, no. I said, I'll tell you what, though. If you ever want to come back, you call me. Now, I've never heard from him. I walked out of his apartment that night with one absolute certainty in my mind that AA don't work. My buddy's drunk tonight. You people have lied to me. This thing is a crock. So I went to the meeting that night to resign. I didn't know that you just don't go no more. I thought you just had to turn something in or... So I'm waiting. And it's a meeting in the church, in one of these church basements in the city of Chicago. This was back when they still had coffee cups. They were, you know, they were green, but most of them they had the brown line from where our coffee sat for years, you know. and the meeting was about 20 people, and the guy that was leading the meeting could easily look at me and go, "This, he's off." So he tried to avoid calling on me, but there was too few people and too much time, so he called on me. And for about the next 5 minutes in an AA meeting, I said things to you that should probably never been allowed to have been said. I cursed you. I used the F word. I told you all were a bunch of mindless sheep. I told you, AA don't work. My buddy's drunk. This thing's a farce. You people liars. And oh, yeah, by the way, I want all my money back. Like I'd been putting any money in your basket. Finally, the guy that was leading the meeting said something very, very important. He said, "Dave, shut up. We're tired of listening." He said, "I want you to know something, because this may be the last time that you're here. And I want you to hear something, because maybe nobody's ever told this to you. But I want you to hear the truth before you go." He said, "The reason that your buddy's drunk tonight isn't because AA don't work." He said, "The reason that your buddy's drunk tonight is because he chose not to work the program of Alcoholics hard enough so that he could obtain sobriety." He said, "That's one thing, but it's not the most important thing." He said, "Dave, I want you to take a look around this room, and I want you to look at every single person in this room, and I want you to look them in the eyes, Dave. I want you to look everybody in the eye, and I want you to understand something about the people that are sitting in this meeting tonight." He said, "There's two types of alcoholics sitting in this room tonight. Good examples of Alcoholics Anonymous and bad examples of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now pick the one you want to be and shut up." Well, now I have my first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. How would I know that there's good examples and bad examples? I'm only hanging out with the bad examples. If somebody at that meeting would have said, "Dave, did you know who came early to set up?" No, because I'm the guy that always comes in late, jingle-jangling my way to my seat. I'm the guy that interrupts the meeting because I'm talking to the guy next to me. I'm the guy that interrupts meetings because I'm trying to make it with some cutie sitting over here. I'm a guy never paying attention. I'm the guy disrespecting the meeting. I'm a guy that dresses inappropriately. I didn't know any of the stuff because I never looked for a sponsor. I just sat there in contempt. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was one of those guys that was pissed. I don't want to be here. And I seem to attract the pissed alcoholic. When I see an angry guy, man, I just want to nuzzle up to him. People would come up to me. I'll tell you the people that I despised the most in AA. The people that had teeth. Because they want to come up and show them to you. "We're so glad you're here. Keep coming back. Man, I just want... come over here and show me your chiclets one more time, buddy. I just smash them." But I don't know any of this stuff. Somebody said, "Do you have a sponsor?" I asked one guy, "Hey, man, would you be my sponsor?" He goes, "Okay." Never talked to him again. Today, I know something about why is it that we go through this very, very difficult time. If you're under 3 months right now, I want you to know that we know what it's like to be new. Our book describes, in our doctor's opinion, something very, very important. See, when my father would say to me in those active moments that I'm out of control and I can't stop, and my father would say something with that anger, "Just stop drinking. Stop." My mother would look at me. Our book talks about frothy emotional appeal. Doesn't suffice. Seldom suffices. My mother would used to yell at me, and the little puddles of white spit would gather at her corner. "That's froth, baby. I mean, don't you know what you're doing to us? Just stop and you'll be all right. And if you're new and you've had somebody say that to you, you know that isn't right. Because when I don't drink, the window seems to get narrower. It's like one of those old toys, the Jack in the Box, and they crank that thing. Dun-dun, 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 and it's going. And I'm not drinking, and I'm supposed to be happy. And it's about, you don't know when it's going to blow, but you're hearing the music. Bam! Where's Dave? Who knows? I mean, he's gone. Our book describes, in the doctor's opinion, what you and I are like when we don't drink. We don't have any recovery, but we don't drink. We're restless, irritable, discontented. So I had to look those words up because my sponsor told me, you know, we're going to get three books, Big Book, 12 and 12 Dictionary. Because I know that you don't have a very, because my vocabulary at that point was pretty small. A lot of four-letter words, long phrases that began with mother. We're going to start looking words up. Definition of the word, restless. Perpetual agitation. Definition of the word, irritable. Again, my personal favorite. Abnormally sensitive. What? No, I'm not. That's why it always sounds like your sponsor's yelling at you. No, Dave, I'm just talking. I just asked you how you were doing if you wanted a cup of coffee. It's like, Jesus. What I heard was you're a piece of crap. Discontented. Relentless craving to obtain something I currently don't have. You bet. Booze. Now, I got all three things. If you're new, you have all three of those. Perpetual agitation. And we're shocked when new people go, how do you know I'm new? Just a wild guess, buddy. But see, we know it sucks to be new. That's why you should only do it once. Keep going out and coming back in and going out. We want to make a big deal when the guy comes back again. Just stay. Stop it. All right? Now, we know, and that's the one great aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we can look into the eyes of that new person and we know what it feels like to be new. We know what it feels like to be crawling out of your skin. We know what it feels like to be carrying the burden of what you did when you were out there. And the guilt and the remorse and the shame of living like I lived. I would try to sleep in those early days of being sober in that goofy halfway house, and I'd just start to close my eyes, and the parade would start. All the people that I lied to, all the people that I harmed, all the people that I committed acts of violence against, all the women that I hurt, all the things that I did in my sick alcoholic life, and that parade just doesn't go once. It finishes and it goes around a block and it starts over. And I can't stop it. And you try to go to an AA meeting. And I'll tell you what ends up happening. And this is the thing that I know. And again, if you're just getting started, today what I recognize is I believe that there are three surrenders in Alcoholics Anonymous that have to be made if I'm to get well. And I mean what our book describes, happy, joyous, free. What our book describes when, you know, we read those promises. The book describes when it says that we've ceased fighting. That this react, I can just walk. I don't even have to fight it. It just naturally comes. It's a promise that happens to us, but I got to work the steps. But the first surrender has to happen fairly quickly if I'm to get started. And that first surrender is, I have to admit out loud in somebody's eyes that I'm one of you. I'm this alcoholic that Silkworth describes as this hopeless guy, that I can't beat this thing. I've tried everything that I could come up with not to take the first drink, and I always lose. I will never forget the first time I heard Clint Hodges tell his story about that review he had, I think, in the military. And the review said something like, Clint continually fails to live up to the low expectations he sets for himself. It's like, I have never heard anything that describes me better than I have continually failed to live up to the screw it. You know, I don't seem to be able to not take that first drink. The second surrender has to happen fairly quickly after that. We had great workshops on the steps. We had great work, but our book talks about there's a preliminary to that. There's a prerequisite to getting started, and I got to find it. And it says, if you've decided you want what we have, and what do you got? See, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I look out, you don't look like the answer to me. But if you've decided you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready for the steps and not before. I had to find that person, and our book describes again in Silkworth's message that the message that can hold an interest like me, an alcoholic like me, has to have depth and weight. And with a year of sobriety, I moved to Norman, Oklahoma. My brother had gone through OU, and he said, why don't you come down here? I can help you get two in-state tuition. I went to Norman, Oklahoma because I thought I was going back to school. I got there in January of 1982, and Jim and Vinoy Shaw moved to Norman, Oklahoma in May of 1982, and my life changed. I did not know that God was getting me to the place where I could hear the message of a man that had, his message had depth and weight, and Jim Shaw saved my life. I would be sitting in those meetings with Jim, and when Jim talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, he had an energy and an enthusiasm for AA that I had never seen. And maybe it was just because I was ready. But when Jim would talk about sponsorship, and he'd talk about his sponsor, and he'd talk about working the steps, and he'd talk about respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, and he would talk about the things that needed to happen so that I could get well, I started to listen. So the second surrender is, I have to say to you, I need your help because I can't do this on my own. And that first and second surrender have to happen fairly quickly if I'm going to get busy. I'm one of you, and I can't do it on my own. I need help. Now, Jim wasn't my sponsor right away. I had a man by the name of Greg, and Greg took me through the steps, and he did all he could for me, but he got drunk when I was 4 years sober. And I worked a pretty decent inventory. And I'll tell you the best description of an inventory that I can. When I lived my life, it seemed like every day I'd come home and I would have that day's trash of the things that I did, the lies that I told, and the stuff that I stole, and the violence that I committed, and the perversion that I live under, just day after day, and week after week, and month after month. And I don't know what to do with this trash. So I come home, and I open the door to the backyard, and I throw that crap out in the backyard, and I shut the door, and I draw the blinds, and I don't look at it. And I do that for all the years of my drinking. And one day, my sponsor comes over with his smile. And I feel like that little kid about to go on that torturous run again. He opens the window. He pulls open the door. He said, Dave, come out here. Oh, crap. And you go out to the backyard, and you look out there, and it's this huge, monstrous pile of crap. And he said, Dave, that's your life. And it's your fault. And he handed me, I don't know if you've ever had like the electric company come to your yard, and they put the little red flags in your yard marking where your lines are. So Jim hands me 1,000 of those little red flags. He goes, come on, kid, we got work to do. And he said, what you're going to do is you're going to take this big pile, and we're going to whittle it down. And he said, I want you to get all your resentments. I want you to get all the fear. I want to get your sex conduct. and your envy and your greed and your lust. And he said, every time you get one, now you're, when you look out, instead of one huge pile, you look out and there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of those little piles, and every one of them's got a little flag in it with something you've written. Resentment, fear, sex, all that stuff. That's the fourth step. Fifth step, get somebody stupid enough to come out into the backyard with you while you tell them about every little pile. And when I got done with that, my sponsor took me by the arms and he put a hug on me and he said, I love you, but we got a lot of work to do. See, I had destroyed the relationship between me and my father. I had damaged severely the relationship between me and my mother. I had destroyed the relationships with my two brothers. There wasn't anybody that had a thing to do with me, and they shouldn't. And my sponsor started giving me direction. He said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want you to go to your parents' home. You just ask if you can come, and you mow your father's yard, and you get into that house, and you clean your mom's kitchen, and you vacuum her carpets, and you do all the things that she hadn't got done that day. Well, I said, my mom's already done the dishes because she's a neat freak, and I don't care. Take all the dishes out, put something on them, and wash them, and put them back. I'd mow my dad's yard. No note. Go the next week. I don't know, it was about 6 weeks later, I get to my dad's house and the lawnmower's on the driveway. Crap. But I'm not a well person. See, I'm one of these guys that thinks AA might happen through osmosis. I just have to sit here. Maybe one day, woo! My sponsor today talks about that Alcoholics Anonymous. So he said, if you want a garden, you better get a hoe. For all you rappers, that's a garden implement. There's some work to be done. And I had a lot of work that I needed to do. And I started on this process. But I was going to University of Oklahoma. I was about to graduate. I was about 4 years sober. And here's one of those times where I decided to call the shots myself. I didn't run this by my sponsor. I'm taking two classes my senior year. One of them's advanced marketing class, and one of them's advanced management class, and they have group projects. And so what I decided to do, and the projects are very similar. So what I decided to do, and I'm the ringleader, I said, hey, why don't we do this? Let's take this project that I've already done and copy it and turn it in over here. And I guess I had some people that, hey, that's great, I don't have to do it. So I didn't change a comma. I just did this. Put it over here, signed the new names, turned it in. What I didn't realize is one of the professors that was teaching this class was also teaching a section of this class. He just looks at us like, Jesus, these didn't look familiar. The only common denominator? Now, I was not a very good student. My grade point was always hanging around the Mendoza line. And this guy calls me into the dean's office and he said, we're going to have to fail you. And he said, in fact, you're going up on academic misconduct charges. And he said, and you're probably going to be expelled from the University of Oklahoma. Now, I'd already called my parents and said, would they come down and see me graduate? And now I had to call them and tell them I'm a cheater. I'm 4 years sober. And not to come because I can't graduate. And all the work that I had done with my father to that point was evaporated. And it's like, man, so now I got to start over. By this time, that first sponsor I had had gotten drunk, and I got Jim as my sponsor, and we started over. And he just said, we're going to keep doing these things. We're going to keep taking actions. And he started telling me all the things that I was going to do, and he said, I don't know what's going to happen, but we're going to take action, and we'll leave the results up to God. On my 15th year AA birthday, for those of you that knew Jim, Jim got diagnosed with cancer in February of 1996, and he was dead in May. My 15th year AA birthday was in January, so he hadn't been diagnosed yet. And he came to give a talk for my 15th year AA birthday. And by this time, I had done a lot of the amends, and I'd done the amends with my mom. Usually moms are going to forgive us faster than dads, and so my amends with my mom was complete, but this thing was hanging over with my father still. We could be in a room together, but you could just tell he was waiting for the shoe to drop. But I kept taking all these actions. On my 15th year AA birthday, there was a gathering, and there was a lot of the people I sponsored, and a lot of people were in the room, and a lot of people stood up and talked about what Alcoholics Anonymous had done in my life, and that they were grateful that I was in their lives, and that people that I sponsored were so grateful that I helped them, and all those people, and AA, you guys looked wonderful. And my father saw that. And Sunday after that weekend was over, I took my parents back to the airport, and I kissed my mom goodbye, and my dad pulled me aside, and he said, there was a time when I thought you had a promising golf career, and I watched you piss it away, and I couldn't take it. He said, but after this weekend, it's obvious you've been called to a higher order. And he hugged me, and he told me that he loved me. And I can tell you that from that day to this, and my father's still alive, that every time my father and I have a conversation, it typically ends something with, Dad, I love you. And Dave, I love you. Now, I can go all the way back to Tulsa, Oklahoma and know that I've been overpaid because I didn't believe it was possible that I'd ever have that relationship back again. And there was nothing other than a sponsor's love and care and truth-telling that allowed that to take place. You know, on page 64 of our book, it may say the most important line of our book, and it says, our liquor is but a symptom. We're going to have to get down to causes and conditions. All my life, people have been treating my symptoms. You know, if you ever catch a cold, you get the cold, and then the symptoms show up. You cough, and you sneeze, and you hack. You can go all those drugstores, and there's just shelves and shelves and shelves of stuff treating the symptoms. Does your cold go away? Doesn't go away. Just your cough's less, or you clear your nose until it goes away. But I sponsor two doctors. They're idiots. They can't cure a cold. And they want to say that they know how to help alcoholism. Silkworth said in 35 that this illness these people have is way beyond our synthetic knowledge. That this power that's going to necessitate the change is beyond their concepts. That the power of good is outside of their ability to regulate it. That God's going to need to enter our lives. And I needed that. When I walked out of that treatment center, they diagnosed me manic depressive, borderline schizophrenic, and that I should probably never walk the streets again without some form of medication treatment. And I can tell you from the day I walked out to this day, I've never taken anything stronger than an aspirin. But my sponsor knew the path. Now the third surrender, and Jim was big on the third surrender. I would call with the problem of the day. Jesus, Jim, big trouble. He would listen for about that long. He'd say, Dave, how many guys are you sponsoring? Jim, did you just hear me? I got trouble. I'll get to my guys, but I got trouble. He goes, how many people are you? Tell me about the guys you're sponsoring. How many people are you working with? It's like a broken record. How many people are you working with? Tell me about them. So I start telling him about that. And then I'd hang up and I'd say, oh, crap, I forgot to tell him about my problem. Do you remember what your problem was last week? But, boy, it was big last week. It was huge. You can look at your face and know you had big problems last week. But now you got a big problem this week. What I didn't realize was the actions in Alcoholics Anonymous, the idea of helping somebody. We know everybody in this room has got difficulty. I'll tell you what my alcoholic mind does with my difficulty. It makes it bigger than yours. My difficulty is bigger than yours. My problems are heavier than yours. Nobody understands what I'm going through. Today my sponsor says, you know what, there's only 7 deadly sins. Nobody gets 8. I just have to I have to find somebody that I can tell the truth to. I need to find somebody that I can tell the truth about what's going on in my life. And in the meantime, whatever experiences I have, what I have found since I've got here is all that stuff that I did wrong, I've been able to turn and use to help somebody else. Because my sponsor helped me get to the other side of it. I did not believe that I could ever have the relationship that I have with my dad. And yet I have it. Because a sponsor took care and he told me the truth. And he said, it's not going to be easy. In fact, I'm not sure what page, but it says simple, but not easy. And then it says this, it's going to require the destruction of self-centeredness. You really want to know what your problem is? It's on page 62. Selfish, self-centered, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, and my personal favorite, self-pity. And my sponsor adds a 6th, self-serving. And with this 6-pack of self, I can go anywhere and rationalize and justify any ridiculous behavior. Now, the 3rd surrender is I'm going to have to surrender the fact that from this point forward I need to be willing to live a life of service. And when I look at the people that are happy and long-term sobriety, you know what's the common thread between the people of long-term sobriety and they still have a joy of living? Is they live a life of service. Do you think they like it every single day? I can promise you they don't. But I can tell you at the end of the day when they've made contact with the person that they love, somebody that they sponsor, somebody that at the meeting that night that surrendered to what we do, I don't know if there's ever been anything better in my life than that when I get the privilege of taking a man through the inventory process and that thing in their eyes changes from that life of isolation to the absolute recognition that God's willing to have them back. I don't know if you've ever had your place of living. I lived like a pig. I don't know if you ever had your apartment or your home so dirty that if somebody, hey, that you came to the door and you, what? You did not want them in because you knew your house was filthy. And you didn't want them to know that you lived like that. Well, my inside house was filthy. Now, how can I ask God to come in? And the thing that I know is I've always wanted to have a relationship with God. But I knew my house was dirty. My sponsor helped me clean house. And by going through 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, my house became presentable to God. You want to know what our book talks about, that our spiritual mode of living is a powerful health restorative. You want to get rid of depression? Live right. But you can't do it for 25 minutes and go, okay, I want to feel better now. You got to do it day after day. I asked my sponsor once, how long does this crap take? He asked me, how long did I drink? He said, you shouldn't expect anything to happen good in your life till you've been here as long as you were drinking. He said, it may happen faster, but you shouldn't expect it. He said, it took a long time for you to screw your life up. We can't fix it overnight. You're going to have to be in it for the long haul. My wife and I have been married for 30 years. She's a member of Al-Anon, and she's an active member. In fact, this West Texas has direct ties to my wife's program. Marcelina White sponsored a gal by the name of Octavia Brooks, who sponsored a gal by the name of Pat Clater, who sponsored a gal by the name of Vinoy Shaw, and Vinoy sponsors my wife. I can never tell you thank you enough for what your message of recovery is. Jack Clater was a man that I knew for a great deal, and I know there's people that knew Jack Clater, and Jack was a very humble man. And Jack Clater told me more about spiritual connection and how to pray and pray rightly, and his relation, when he would talk about his relationship with God, tears would come to his eyes. And I love that about that man. And these, Jim Shaw and Jack, were the men that saved my life because they cared enough to tell me the truth. And my wife, Susan, tells you a big hello. Last thing I'll tell you is one of the hardest things I've ever had to go through is watching my mom dying of alcoholism. It was the only thing that my wife and I would fight about. Because we'd have to go to my parents' home, and my mom's got cirrhosis, and alcoholism is terrible to people, but it seems to beat women up pretty badly, and my mom's real thin with cirrhosis, and she's deteriorating before our eyes. And I would call Jim, and I would tell him, I can't stand it. And he said, I know. He would tell me about his father, and Jim's dad got sober when he was 78. In fact, there was an article in the Grapevine that Jim's dad, at that point, and this was back in the mid-80s, that Jim's dad was the oldest person to ever get sober. And there was an article in the Grapevine about it. And I got to sit in some meetings with Jim's dad, and his dad would talk about that this was the best time of his life. So he would tell me, he said, I don't know what's going to happen with your mom, but we're going to keep doing the right stuff. And one day, my dad had lost his job, and through a series of circumstances, he was at home, and he woke up one early morning, and my mom wasn't in the bed, and he found her in the kitchen chugging down a bottle of vodka. And he called me the next day, and we talked about it, and he called me about a week later. It was the 8th day of January in 1993, and he called me. He said, hey, man, we just stuck your mom in a treatment center. And on the 8th day of January in 1994, I got to stand up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Sarasota, Florida, and I got to hand my mom her one-year sober medallion. And on the 8th day of January in 1998, I got to stand up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to hand my mom her five-year sober medallion. And in 2003, my mom and my dad flew to Tulsa, and my sobriety date's the 2nd of January, and my mom's is on the 8th. We celebrated our birthday that night, and it was my mom's 10-year sober medallion. I got to hand her a 10-year medallion. And my dad stood up in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he thanked AA from the bottom of his heart for the lives of his son and his wife. Now, what do I owe? What do I owe? I owe you everything I have. When Jim was dying, I flew out to, by this time he was out in Palm Valley, Palm Desert, out near wherever that is, out in California. And the diagnosis was already in. He was diagnosed in February. This was about March. And I went out there to tell him goodbye. They had already said, it's terminal, we can't stop it. It was in his lymph nodes and it was moving towards his brain and they couldn't stop it. And I went out there to tell that man thank you. And how do you tell somebody that has saved your life? What words can I possibly say to Jim at that point? Thank you. And I just went out there and I told him how much I loved him and that I can't pay back what you've done for me. He said, I know. He said, I've been trying to carry this message for almost 30 years. And he said, it's obvious my time's done. He said, now it's your turn. And he looked at me and he said, don't water it down. And he told me to get along with Calvin, who was a brother sponsoree that I had a little animosity towards. out in California, they have celebrations with the class. Jim was the class of 66. He got sober in 66. And so that class included Jim, and the last people in that class were Jim, Clint Hodges, and a guy by the name of Byron, and I don't remember Byron's last name. Well, okay. And they were coming out, and so it was they were coming from L.A. Clancy was coming, and Clint and Byron. And Jim was in his chair, and Vinoy told me this. I wasn't there personally to see it, but I just want to tell you. And he was sick, and he was dying, and he'd gotten his coat on. He had loosened his tie, and he was just slumped over in the chair. And Clancy and Clint and Byron drove up, and when he saw that, Jim got out of his chair, and he straightened his tie, and he walked to the door to greet his sponsor. And that's the type of man that my sponsor was. The man that I have today, I love. He's been my sponsor for 19 years, a man by the name of John. He's out in California, and he cares about Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can tell you that what I owe was given to me by a man by the name of Jim Shaw. Every morning I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because of Alcoholics Anonymous, a sponsor who loved me enough to tell me the truth, and all of you that have given me your hearts, that today I have a relationship with God. And for that, I will always be grateful. Thank you very much.